Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 24.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fly protect 3,
low speed, 5
for
the delay.
My bird ramp curveballs at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted 6002 is still active.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening. This episode is going to be with Major Jeff Bender Page. He's an F-35 pilot. He has been an F-16 instructor pilot as well as an F-16 evaluator. He has deployments to Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and he's done a little bit of work. We're not going to talk about his career today. Instead, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the previous episode, episode 23, the Shaw Air Force Base mishap, the resultant loss of life, Lieutenant David Smits. Again, if you're looking to support that a good cause and a good organization, go over to lieutenantsmits.org. I have that linked on the afterburnpodcast.com, as well as an additional page in there, which talks about it has the Accident Investigation Board report on there. It talks about F-16 landing with a few graphics and videos on there. So if you're looking for some more content, you can go to afterburnpodcast.com. You can find the link for Mezzer's Foundation there. Again, swing over there and you can have a little bit more context, which is the goal of this episode. I debated and actually recorded episode 23 twice. I didn't know if I was going to do it because it hits relatively close to home. Still know a lot of the parties involved. And it's one of those, you don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback because people are going through some hell. This episode, how I wanted Bender to come on in so we could have another perspective and really kind of build a little bit bigger picture as far as what was going on around that mishap. Now, neither one of us were there. So that's full disclosure. It comes along with it. But I think, and when you listen to the episode, you can definitely appreciate the fact that I think both of us could have found ourselves in that situation in any point of that mishap there. So my heart goes out to Mezzer's family. And again, you know, hope to prevent something like this in the future. We all can learn from it and be better and stronger from it. Before we get into the episode, I'd like to thank all those who've gone over to iTunes and subscribed and hit the 5-star review. If you haven't done so, please consider going over, take the 10 seconds to hit a 5-star review and drop a word. It can just be one word in the review there, because that helps the podcast expand its reach, expand the number of people it reaches, which definitely helps the podcast grow. Just hit a year with 160,000 downloads. So again, I'm very appreciative of everyone who's been following along on the journey. I've enjoyed it and hopefully you have as well. I also like to thank my Patreon supporters. They've helped the podcast grow, venturing into video podcasts. So the YouTube site is up and it is slowly growing. So you'll start seeing more content up there, as well as Patreon supporters get exclusive content and access, as well as priority for the question and answer sessions, which are going to start dropping here very soon. You can swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast if you want more information or if you're looking to support the podcast. With that being said, let's get into the episode with Bender as we break down further from episode number 23, F-16 mishap at Shaw Air Force Base.
Well, I'm excited. I got my good buddy, Jeff Bender Page. He is fighter pilot extraordinaire. Bender, would you tell everyone just like a 30-second elevator pitch of who you are, like where you started and kind of what you're doing today?
Yeah, sounds good. It's funny because I listened to a couple of your podcasts with my kids in preparation for talking to you. So Ben was like, what's an elevator speech? I was like, oh, you talk yourself up, you know, to explain. He's like, you don't need an elevator speech. You need it, you know, maybe some stairs will do. I'm like, oh, it hurts a little bit, Ben.
That's awesome.
It's kind of true though. So I, you know, with you, that's where I met you, obviously, was the first part of the career being a T6 instructor pilot in Columbus, Mississippi. So I was an ROTC graduate initially from Brigham Young University, wanted to be a pilot. So I got my pilot spot to Columbus. I went through pilot training. It was a great experience. It didn't, as you know, the Air Force goes through cycles. So the cycles were doing some weird stuff at that time. So we ended up being FAPES together in the T6, which was an awesome assignment. Out of there, I got an F-16. Went to B course at Luke, and then got my follow-on assignment to Misawa, Japan, which was, so both those assignments, the one in Mississippi and the one to Japan, were not what I had envisioned in like my dream like pilot career.
Right.
But both ended up being pretty amazing assignments. Misawa, which just, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better place to learn to be a fighter pilot and to deploy for the first time, to go through an instructor upgrade, all those things. I mean, it's a challenging environment. Pretty unique as far as where it's located in Japan, let alone in the world. So it was an awesome experience. And then followed that up, rejoined you back at Shaw in South Carolina, where I spent my last 3 years of active duty flying Block 50s there in the Gamblers. Jumped out of the active duty into the reserves, spent a year doing part-time reserves there at Shaw. And then I flew for Delta for that time to try to set up the bridge between military career and then what was going to happen after the military with the airlines. And then I timed everything pretty well, accidentally, of course. I went back to an active assignment to transition over to the F-35 right before COVID-19 kind of swept the legs out from underneath airlines this past spring. So I was able to get back to a full-time job in the Air Force up at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, where I am now. And that's what I'm doing now. For the next 3 years, I have orders. So we'll spend time raging around in Fat Amy,
yeah,
as we call her. Well, some people call her. Some people don't like that term, but it's it is pretty appropriate, honestly.
It is what it is, right? No, yeah. super humble because you've accomplished a lot. F-16 instructor pilot, F-16 evaluator, now flying the F-35. So you're doing a bunch. And I'll say the funny story I have is, or one of them, because I have many with you, but stands out is when you're Misawa time, right? Like it's always snowing up there and you guys are used to that. Like I had never seen snow in an Air Force airplane. And I remember flying, getting ready for the Super Bowl flyover, and I'm in Minneapolis and it is just, I'm watching 12 snow plows go down the runway and I'm wondering, can I go fly? And you were the guy I called to like talk about like de-icing and stuff. And even funnier than that is talking to Blitz, the former commander afterwards. And I was like, yeah, I just ran the de-icing checklist, acting like I knew what I was talking about because I'd gotten it from you. He's like, we have one of those, you know, yeah. So someone who's been in the F-16 for 20 yeah. years. Super accomplished. And I appreciate you joining me here. Something a little bit different today. You know, you and I talked a little bit about, and this is an idea that spurred kind of over the past like couple days. But the feedback from last episode, Mezzer's mishap. So if you haven't listened to that episode, you're going to go listen to that, where I went through the Accident Investigation Board's report of Mezzer's mishap at Shaw in June of 2020, which resulted in the loss of life. I went back and forth on doing that episode if I wanted to do it or not. And I ended up, I actually recorded it twice. The second iteration, it's purely just me going through the accident investigation report, kind of breaking down some of the terms. And I had a few people ask that. It was kind of surface level and that was intentional. But I wanted to be able to go through it at a little bit deeper level and have someone with a little bit more credibility than myself. So that's why I picked you. But we could kind of go through that accident report and maybe add a little bit of context around it, because obviously it is factual and that's what we want out of those reports. And it's definitely beyond surface level, but I think adding a little bit of context around it would be helpful for some people who are familiar or even unfamiliar with it. So we've decided to kind of dig into that. We'll see where this goes. Again, this is kind of uncharted territory, I think, for both of us, because we definitely know parties involved. So there's a few lines that we definitely don't want to cross. But again, I think there's a lot of value that's in this that we can add to it. So buckle up.
Awesome. Let's do it. Yeah, here we go. We have a lot of angry friends probably.
Well, you know, I mean,
hopefully not.
No, I think this overall, I mean, like when I heard about the mishap, obviously there's a lot of questions, and then reading the accident investigation report, we talk about the Swiss cheese model as far as accidents go, you know, all those pieces of Swiss cheese have to line up, and then the hole, you just, you know, shoot the gap there, so to speak. And this is definitely one of those where you're talking about, you know, this guy who is, you know, new to the jet, not flying a bunch. You know, the tolerance for error in a fast moving jet left or right, when you're going that fast, one little mistake, can result in a fatality, right? Where in going slower speeds or doing other things, it's going to result in a Band-Aid, right? So the tolerance for error are much smaller when it comes to it. And unfortunately, this is what he gets painted into. I think backing it up, like the environment, yeah, the Air Force is going through a bunch of changes as far as pilot training, streamlining the syllabi that go into it. I don't know. In that report, it doesn't encompass his training syllabi, what it took for him to get there, other than the fact that he had never refueled. And that's why I think the big takeaway, so the first time Mezer is going in there and he is tanking at night, first time he's tanking is at night, and also in here is COVID, right? So the guys aren't flying a bunch. So there's a lot of contributing factors that kind of roll into this. Yeah, I don't know, like what your kind of your initial thoughts are when you read it, like red flags or concerns or just general thoughts.
Yeah, definitely the what you don't get from AIBs, right, is the context of the, you know, the environment that he, that not only him, but the other players in the accident, commander and the instructor cadre in the squadron, you know, none of that really comes out like you're saying. We don't really understand, or you don't get the feeling of the background for it all. So it is easy to read it and to notice the big errors that were made. Like, how could we, you know, how did each of those errors get made? First of all, individually, like it, some of them seem pretty, you know, blatant, but the fact that they're all made in sequence or whatever, like you said, to line up so that it ends up in a mishap. It's, but when you understand the context of it, you know, you can see that honestly, we're lucky, I think, in a lot of ways, this doesn't happen as often as it probably could happen. So I remember when the first pilot I was aware of, at least, I was working in the OGB shop. So the operations group commander has a Stanley Val. So the guy who's basically in charge of linking him with the squadrons as far as the emergency procedures, the setup of the airfield for how it's going to deal with those different procedures, not just emergencies, but standardizing all the different procedures. And so when one of our new pilots came,
I'll say, yeah, you're the guy. Yeah, you're doing all the check rides for those listening. Like, I mean, you kind of downplay the OGV role, but you're the guy who's setting the tone. I mean, obviously from the commander, but you're the evaluator.
Yeah, that's the intent of that position. Yeah, anybody who knows me, obviously. Like, what is he doing there? That's right. And so we got the first pilot out of B course, and he hadn't done tanking. And so this, the broader Air Force context this time is there's this very significant fighter pilot shortage. It's been happening for years. They had come up with different task force and stuff on how they were going to try to attrit some of the losses of the experience level leaving the Air Force, as well as how are they going to increase the pipeline to get students through into the fighter squadron. So that's kind of where we are, broad picture in the Air Force. So we're starting to get these students from pilot training or from the F-16B course who haven't done some of these fundamental things that honestly the CAF, the combat squadrons, aren't prepared to do, like tanking. Like, none of us has ever taken the back seat of an aircraft. That's a very specific skill set that only instructors are given in the basic course, you know, at Luke Air Force Base or Holloman Air Force Base. So here we're getting these guys, and they don't have to do it from you know, a two-seat F-16. It's not required. But there's no way for us to know whether this guy is going to be ready to do it in a single-seat aircraft or if he's going to need extra instruction. And there's nobody there that can give that extra instruction anyway. So it was a problem that we, you know, we were a little bit shocked that that was going to be put on the lap of the combat air forces. And we weren't sure, you know, exactly how to deal with it. The first couple guys that went through it ended up not being an issue. And, you know, you've experienced plenty of times tanking. Like, it can be a smooth, great day where things are going really well for not only for the F-16 pilot, but also for the KC-135 pilot and the boom operator.
Right.
And so it's not, you know, not a terribly big issue. Or it can be circumstances that are incredibly challenging, like weather, bad weather, bad boom operator, you know, all those things can contribute to that. So it just, like you said, the Swiss cheese model, like the first couple of times there wasn't an issue, but, you know, in this particular case, as we're going to see, as we talk about it, you know, it, that was actually a significant issue. It didn't directly affect probably the way, or at least it wasn't directly linked to when he struck his left strut. But it definitely played into his mental processing after the failed refueling. So my point being, like, the broad picture of the Air Force is we're starting to rush things, or at least that's the feeling that the CAF has, the Combat Air Forces had, is that we're rushing things on the training side of the house. And some of that slack needs to now be picked up by the combat squadrons, who honestly aren't, they're not made to do that kind of stuff. They're not necessarily prepared or have the right syllabuses or syllabi in place to do it. So it brings up some interesting questions.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I remember specifically the director of operations I had when I first showed up to Shaw. So brand new dude out of the B course. He was a weapons school instructor, one of the best instructors I've ever had. And I think he was like the weapons school instructor of the year, like 2 times in a row. So he knows everything about tactics and how to fly the F-16. And I was sitting in a debrief with someone else and he's like looking at their tapes and he goes, yeah, I mean, I guess that's like that'd be a pretty new guy thing to do. Like he was at such a different level, such an advanced level that the basic stuff, and I could say this, I mean, the same thing, it's apples and oranges, right? But if I had to go teach someone to fly a Cessna right now, and I've done that, I'm like, there's so many things that I don't know about this small plane that I can't teach you that just are not applicable in the stuff that I fly today. So, yeah, it's interesting that that's been transposed, but it also compounding factor, I think, the tempo of ops, like that hasn't changed. In fact, it's ramped up. And I almost like draw a mirror. So, you know, we had a mishap in our squadron when I was deployed in 2014. And the events leading up to that, you know, to the deployment, everything was rushed. We're trying to get so many people through qualifications. I imagine that had to be somewhat the same scenario here, but magnified with the fact that they're behind because COVID has ramped down flying operations for a few months, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember, you know, I was there when you got to Jordan, you ripped our squadron out. So we kind of crossed paths there for a little bit. And I knew Pyro from a previous life, but the same, you know, it's just interesting. I mean, Pyro is a super experienced instructor pilot. I don't think anybody would doubt his capabilities. His path was, you know, going to be probably a very powerful leader in the F-16 community. But you just, I mean, like you said, things happen very fast. The airplanes are unforgiving. Jordan was, you know, an unforgiving environment to fly in, especially with combat operations going on. The airfield was, again, it's made up to the standard that we're used to in the United States. There's all these compounding factors that you just can't identify each one as possible. And it definitely becomes much more difficult to do that, like you're saying, in an ops tempo that is, you know, that is rushed or kind of unsustainable. COVID-19, I don't think we really understand yet or have seen all the ramifications of what that did to flying. It's a little bit similar to back in 2012 and 13, I think, when we had sequestration and they started to slow down ops in a lot of squadrons. And it slowed down ops in a lot of squadrons, but that also meant that other squadrons had to pick up a lot of the tempo because we still had to meet requirements, you know, downrange and stuff. So when you start to introduce things like that, the destabilized squadrons, like we just can't identify all the little pieces that are either getting missed or that start to kind of fall to the wayside and focus on other things. And so it just creates more and more, you know, little things that can go wrong that can lead to some of these mishaps. And so Shaw has traditionally been a place where the ops tempo can get out of hand, I think,
yeah.
in a lot of cases. So at the time, you know, I was just a reservist at the time of this accident. In fact, I left about a month or so after Mesrick got there. So I remember him getting to the squadron, you know, chatting in the bar, complaining about his jalapeno popcorn, burning the jalapenos. but we never flew together. But the tempo at the time, you know, it was a great squadron. It is a great squadron, honestly. Like, awesome leadership, awesome instructor cadre. Very, you know, driven to be very tactical in what they're doing. They're also set to, you know, deploy later that year. So there's a lot of excitement about the future and stuff. But I can't imagine what COVID, you know, the going from that super high energy, getting in a good rhythm of training and then just stopping it, you know, which is what happened, I think, you know, in that. And so guys like Mesrick and, you know, the less experienced guys, they don't have stuff to fall back on, experience to fall back on when things are changing and a little bit unstable. So I think he had only flown two missions, right, in the previous month to the accident, for the previous 2 months prior or something. So very few amount of flights for a fighter pilot, you know, especially an inexperienced fighter pilot. Every time, even me in the F-16 with, you know, a ton of hours, years flying it, if I went even a couple weeks, you know, I'd go fly a Delta trip and come back and I would sit in the airplane and I would have to take, you know, 10 to 20 seconds to just remember or to think through, like, okay, how exactly am I going to start this thing? Or like, what am I looking for now as I throw this switch, you know?
Yep.
But I had all that experience I could look back on, you know, in the habit patterns. Mesrick, guys like Mesrick, you know, who are brand new to an airplane, like that stuff just isn't there. And so there's a lot of, you know, you can just, not necessarily that he missed specific stuff or anything, obviously, but it just becomes much more challenging, much more draining mentally and all that stuff. So I think you nailed it. I think the destabilizing effect of high operations tempo versus all, like, shut it down real quick versus how do we get back to high operations tempo, all that stuff has effects, certainly for, you know, the pilots who are flying in the squadron.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I think you and I honestly say, you take us and you put us in that environment, it'd be the exact same thing. Like, this is not a Monday morning quarterback, right? Like, I could very easily see myself in any one of those positions. In fact, I've been there. And I remember, you know, like, my first, like, night tanking in combat, like, that was probably where 90% of my energy went to, was just trying to, you know, figure out where I was spatially in relation to everything in the AOR, and then getting on the tanker, you know, and then where are we going next? What frequencies? And that was a lot of brain bites that were being burned doing that. And up to that point, we had a good amount of reps, right? But I didn't have a whole lot of experience to fall back onto, you know, but by, you know, the end of the month, right, that was like just putting on your pants and going to work. Like, you didn't think about it, but you had to get those reps in order to be at that point. And so this is a really challenging spot to be in. And I think the fact that Shaw is so busy, and again, everyone there is a type A mission oriented, and they have a line in the sand with an objective they have to hit to get out the door to go do the mission. So they're going to push and do everything they can in order to do it. I will say, you know, they had identified the fact that, hey, this is a, you know, risky situation. So in the AIB, it does outline, they went back to the basics. They had, you know, a push to go back to the basics. And again, I remember doing something similar to it, but, you know, that's the highlight to the squadron. I'm sure there was a pilot meeting about it, probably an email about it. And then in every flight briefing, they're going to talk about just the basics, which is, you know, takeoff, landing, refueling, the admin portion of the fight, or the, you know, the flight that we normally don't think about. So there was an emphasis on it, but again, everyone in the squadron is rusty or could be rusty because of just the lack of flying. We can make that assumption. But for an inexperienced guy, not getting those reps is definitely going to be challenging. At least it would be for me. Like, I know for a fact, just not getting those reps would be challenging.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Same.
Yeah, it's, you know, and you go through it. So obviously he can't get gas. He and his flight lead, his element lead, they come back to Shaw. And, you know, I know he verbalizes over his, over the radio that he's frustrated. Element lead tries to make it lighthearted. And again, I know that I know the element lead, right? If I was at spot, like he's trying to make it lighthearted because Mesner's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, I would imagine, because he knows that mission is ineffective because he couldn't get gas. That's a really tough spot to be in. No fighter pilot wants to be the wedge or the guy that lets the team down. And it's one of those things, like, you can tell that it's weighing on him based on the report and what they've identified in the HUD tape. And then, you know, he comes back and makes one small error, right? Like, I say it's a small error. We're talking a couple degrees, right? But you're talking a couple degrees, a few thousand feet, as well as 170 knots, right? Like, small mistake at that point, it doesn't bode well for, you know, Mesner and his aircraft.
Right.
And going through this, right? You know, they get into the traffic pattern. You know, Mesner's mistake there, right? Which is the causal factor for this mishap. Again, that's something like I've had stuff go like, whew, that could have gone south on me, right? So again, I can very easily place myself. And I think any fighter pilot that says they've never been in a spot where they at the end of the sort of like, you know, said, whew, that could have been bad, is probably lying. So unfortunately, Mesner's here is just on the left side of the mistake. And it's one that results in damage to the aircraft and makes it really tough to recover. I think then going into, you know, they spend about 30 minutes going through the checklist and trying to resolve this issue. You know, what stood out to me was the F-16 landing gear checklist. I had to go back and look at it, but I remember these from like the EP sims. Like, this is a gnarly checklist. It is a long checklist and it is a complicated checklist. And you throw it at night, you throw it after the tanking incident. And then one thing is Mesner's knows he's bent metal. So that's gotta be a huge amplifying factor as far as like what's going to happen now, things like, so he's got a lot of weight on his shoulders as everyone's trying to troubleshoot this.
Yeah, I think you made a great point, especially, you know, just even in the traffic pattern stuff, like you're saying that, I mean, every pilot knows, probably every Air Force pilot, because you kind of taught it in pilot training, but in the fighter world for sure, you know, we talk about snowballing mistakes and errors and stuff. And so we don't even know where it could go back to his ground ops. It could go back to the taxi out, the takeoff, something could happen on takeoff. I mean, there's a lot of little things that could have bothered him and put him off his mental game, you know, just a little bit. Stuff that won't come out in the AIB, you know, so as he's getting to the tanker and he's flying information waiting for his turn to tank, like all these things are kind of compounding with this like difficult situation. And so there's a lot more than just the tanking that's probably weighing on him. It could go back to conversations. Like, he feels a lot of pressure, like you were saying. Like, they're on a tight timeline to try to get out the door and deploy. He wants to be one of the guys who's going to go in just a couple short months. So he knows that this ride has to get done in order for him to be MQT complete and like mission qualified to go. I mean, so there's just that context of all that pressure that's on him leads to very easily snowballing your thought processes, right? So like you're saying, like on that approach, you know, he's stable. It talks about the AIB. He's stable on the ILS. Everything's looking really good. He's out of the weather. He can see the runway environment just fine. And so, you know, flying the ILS in the weather is a little bit taxing. So maybe, you know, in my experience, at least, like when things are clearly, you know, a little bit difficult, it's a little bit easier to focus. Like, I really need to nail this ILS. As soon as he breaks out of the weather. And again, just going back to me, like I can see, like, I wouldn't take that like nice XL, like, okay. Yeah. See the runway environment. So maybe I have time now to think about like the things that I've done wrong, you know, now to think about like, oh, this sucks that I screwed up.
Right.
The tanking couldn't do it. Anyway, so he starts to get down, you know, other trains of thought or whatever, but obviously that's not the time to do it, but that's also, you know, the time that happens a lot for a lot of us. And so it can very quickly, like you said, like, turn into maybe, you know, we catch it or we've caught it in our past experiences, but this particular time he didn't catch, you know, that his flight path marker was in two. He can't see the details. Obviously, it's night, so he just sees lights, not the height of the lights or anything like that. So I think the snowball effect is definitely something that's going on for him. And then to hit, I mean, I don't know if even taxiing the F-16 at like 20 knots and you hit a funny bump or you even go over like the cable, you know, like I don't know, every time it like puts a little like, you know, it's a little jolting or whatever. Anything that's not smooth than what you're expecting.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A fighter airplane is scary, and so I can't even imagine what it felt like to hit something, you know, foreign with your landing gear that you're not expecting, and it's night. Like, that is terrifying. So the next, you know, getting off the ground, like, thank goodness they were able to get off the ground, get start working the checklist and stuff. But I, you know, having the mental discipline then to like calm your thoughts down and to settle down, and then to get into this, like you said, this checklist that is a monster. I mean, throughout my entire F-16 flying and F-35 flying, honestly, like, the big fear was at the end of the mission, I would have a certain amount of, you know, like, not that much gas left. And I'd throw down landing gear and it would show something that I was not expecting.
Right.
That checklist is not something that you can just like run simply. No. It's not always very clear. And I know, even from my experience as a Viper, that there are lots of landing configurations and stuff that I didn't have an answer for yet. Like, it was going to take a lot of like digging through it, trying to figure it out. So, I mean, I can't imagine, again, like going back to the context of like what's going on in this cockpit, it's not simple. It's not as easy as just like, oh, read this checklist. Like, oh, now I should, you know, not to like minimize what the AIB's findings are and stuff, but it's not as simple a thing that's going on between those two cockpits. Like, to talk about the coordination between his element lead and him and the soft, like, those are all really challenging things to be able to communicate effectively together, and to talk about things that are not super clear, even as you're reading them out of checklist. And he's trying to do this, and it's dark in his cockpit, and he's close to the ground because he's in the landing pattern. He's trying to follow his element lead around, so he still has some sort of, you know, the deconfliction is probably pretty well set, but he doesn't get a throw on the kind of autopilot that you and I are used to in, like, the airline world, right? So he's still flying, hand flying at night with this, you know, pretty big deal damage to his aircraft, and at the same time he's got this dark cockpit with this checklist that doesn't stay open in the page that you want to stay open to. You got to look down and like with your flashlight and read one line at a time, try to follow with your fingers. Like, so this is the kind of environment that is, that even the most experienced and confident fighter pilots, we don't want this kind of, we don't want to be here for sure. I don't want to ever be there, obviously. So I can, again, like, the context of it is pretty rich. You know, it's a difficult place to be.
Yeah, I think so. To circle back, because you hit several really, I think, salient points here. Then the first being, the if you go all the way back, is stepping out the door. I don't know. I didn't look and see what day of the week June 30th was. I should have done that. But, you know, night weeks are typically like 2 week stretches, right? So you might do 2 weeks of night week, and then the next time there's a night week or weeks, it might be 2 months or 3 months down the road. There was probably one more night iteration, but it was probably focused on doing close air support, I imagine, as they're going out the door. So, you know, if you don't get this, right, there's only like X number of opportunities, and usually there's only like one or two opportunities. And if this sortie doesn't go on this day, and it's effective, then there's no other opportunity to do it. Or there might be one backup, and then that's going to be have a, you know, a rain or a waterfall effect as far as knocking other people off schedules and things like that. I definitely know there are times like in upgrades where you're looking, you're like, I only got this one day to do it, right? Otherwise it's not going to happen for 3 or 4 months. So that definitely had to be weighing on him. I would imagine it's weighed on me before in the past. And another point I never really thought about reading this was, yeah, like the F-16 is so sensitive that if you go over a bump or if you're going 20 knots, I mean, if you watch it, you know, the nose is just bobbing. So hitting something in the jet going that fast, the startle effect just alone of having something, but, you know, that jarring effect would be really unnerving. So like you said, I think a phenomenal job of one, having the wherewithal to go around and then calming himself down to be able to go through fly formation, work with the flight lead, work with the SOF, and go through that checklist. Because again, that checklist is just absolutely heinous when it comes to digging through it.
Yeah, it sure is.
You know, it leads into, you know, some other aspects of it, which the AIB found was the fact that the supervisor flying, so that F-16 pilot sitting in the tower, and there were actually two of them because one was doing an upgrade. They didn't do a conference hotel call. So Lockheed Martin offers services, I imagine, to all of its platforms where they can, you know, users such as Shaw Air Force Base, F-16 pilots, or F-35s can call Lockheed Martin and they can talk to engineers about these weird type scenarios if there's gas. This is one that I know it's in the checklist. I think I said it in the last episode. I can't say that I would probably have done anything different than the guys sitting in the tower. I don't know. I don't know if I would have the wherewithal to do the conference hotel because usually there's just not enough gas. I feel like it's something we like talk about in the upgrade and kind of brush over. But usually it's emergencies that 99% of the time you've had in the sim, you've had in real life, or you've heard about, or you've talked about ad nauseum. So this is one that, again, just it's one more piece of, you know, Swiss cheese, right, where the hole lines up. This is, this is a tough one too. So obviously, I was like, they would have recommended the ejection versus trying to land it. But, they didn't consider calling them, or at least in the AIB, the upgrading SOF considered it, but he didn't voice his opinion about it. And the guy who was actually in the soft position did not, you know, go down the conference hotel route.
Yeah. So you and I, we've both sat soft, and now this one hits close to home too. Again, these guys are all very close friends of mine. So, and I have sat soft with them and discussed things like this with them before. And so I agree with you. I don't think I would have done anything differently, which is, you know, that's scary to say something like that, because maybe that would have saved Mezger's life, you know? Maybe, I don't know, or maybe not. Who knows what could have been different, but certainly the idea of a conference hotel, now I think of it differently after reading this report, though I'm not sure that it would exactly work out the way the AIB kind of hopes it would work out. But maybe it would. Definitely something to give a shot. But like you said, like I don't want to make excuses or anything like that or whatever. But it's not getting phones to work in the Air Force or computers to work. that doesn't happen. It's not super easy in the soft tower. That stuff's not always up to date and always I don't know. There's just not a whole lot of faith that we put into our technology type backups. And that's how I've always kind of considered conference hotel. This really good idea that no one has ever used. So I'm going to call that number and no one's going to have any idea what I'm talking about. I'm never going to get a hold of said person. And there is a ton of stuff that the SOF is dealing with right now. He's not just sitting there following through in the checklist, right? There are other airplanes out in the airspace. He's got to figure out how to get them home and the fuel that they're limited to. He's got to change the runway to make sure that we can try this approach on cable. There's a ton of stuff that the SOF is dealing with. And the right idea, it probably is in the future to call that conference hotel, try to get that thing established. But I am not surprised that he tabled that so that he could do the other things that he needed to do to try to get this thing resolved. So I think that's a great lesson for, you know, future stops and stuff. And so, but again, there's a ton going on for him, and he successfully got everybody home. He switched the runway, which is not an easy process. It doesn't happen very quickly. He's got to monitor a lot of stuff as that's going on to make sure the cable's ready. And again, this is all happening at night and not super great weather. So it's not, again, 20 minutes might seem like a long time in an AIB when you read it, but 20 minutes goes by really fast. And again, there's a ton of pieces that are going into this. And so again, like thinking back to the conference hotel, like I wish, you know, they would have tried it and maybe the outcome would have been different. You know, we hope it would be in the future and stuff, but
I think that's,
that's a tough thing to pin on that one decision. Like, I just don't, you know, I'm not sure I buy that completely. But
yeah, I think you said a good point, not to make excuses for it, right? Because maybe that would have changed it. But I think the context you just brought to that is really important, because in my mind, as a SOF, right, he's got his element lead out there. They're working as a two ship, and that SOF is a supporting asset, basically, at that point to back those guys up. But, you know, my mind, and maybe it's the wrong way to view it, you know, or viewed it, would have been, hey, they're kind of primary and they're working it, and you're kind of like the filter to catch anything that's going to drop through. But two, yeah, you think like, all right, if I make this phone call, it's going to take 20 minutes to get an engineer on the phone. And like you said, the runway change, that is no small feat. He does have, I don't know how many other aircraft there are airborne, but he's working their recovery to make sure that those guys know that if they're in the middle of the fight, to knock off their fight, to conserve gas, because he doesn't know what's going to happen back at the airfield, to get them back to the airfield, get them on the deck to, you know, reduce variables. So there's a lot going on, and he's kind of working all those and backing those guys up at the same time. So those are the things that I think the context, that not that it's impossible to capture that in the AIB, but I think is really tough to capture in the AIB. And also, yeah, it's the soft, fuzzy pieces of being a human being and the things that are going on there. So I think the one thing I took away from that was that the upgrading SOF thought about the conference hotel, but didn't verbalize it. And so for me, I definitely know I've been in those situations where you're like, this doesn't seem really smart. What are we doing here? And as I got older, and I honestly, you know, it's probably till I'm, you know, a major and now into this part of the career, like I have no problem saying, most of the time, there'll definitely be scenarios where I'm sure I won't be perfect, but saying, this is a tough call, but it's the right call. We shouldn't do it. Like, we actually didn't fly a leg, you know, a revenue leg because of fatigue, and some mistakes are made in the checklist amongst the crew, right? Saying, hey, this is kind of dumb. Like, what's the point of doing this? And that's a tough thing to do, to speak up. So I think that's probably like the thing I've taken away the most, right? Is I might have a bit of information. It doesn't matter how experienced you are. And if you're flying with a guy who's flown this jet for 3,000 hours, whatever, like, you might have a bit of information to present it. At least do it appropriately. And if it's taken, great. If not, then, you know, move on.
Yeah, I think that's just, and I think there are other examples in the AIB or in the events that happen that kind of are that same, you know, a couple times Mezra says, you know, like, are you sure this is what I should be doing? So I think, you know, again, not to like put thoughts into everybody's minds, because I'm not exactly sure, but my guess is that that's indicative of him having his own, he's not comfortable with what's about to happen, right? Or yeah, kind of that the thought process is going down. And again, so to provide a little bit of, like, you understand that completely, like, I, as a new fighter pilot, you don't want to say, right? Like, you're, right, you know, it's a joke in the fighter pilot world, right? You get three responses, which is whatever, two lead you're on fire and save the fat one for me. Like, that has its place. Honestly, I think that that's a very important lesson for fighter pilots.
Yes.
But it's also very, that translates into, like you said, I don't want to be the wedge. I don't want to be questioning things or like not willing to do things that I'm supposed to make happen, like in the culture of being a fighter pilot. So the backup SOF is thinking probably the same things, like, here's a good idea, but I'm unfamiliar with this, you know, environment in the SOF tower, so I don't want to get in the way of the SOF. Mezra's probably thinking similar things, like, I kind of think that this is like maybe not the best idea, but here are very experienced people who think it is a good idea, so like, what's the limit of what I'm willing to say, or like, how do you put your foot down? So
yeah, it's an art and there's a fine line. I think, you know, it is appropriate for, you know, to lead your own fire and save the fat one for me. There's definitely majority of the time and place for that, right? Where, I mean, brevity is important. There's just not a lot of time to discuss things. But again, it's like, where's the line of voicing your opinion, or, you know, hey, I think it's like, hey, bring it up, right? And maybe you bring it up in a couple different ways if you really feel adamant about it. But it's tough. Like, there's no right or wrong answer here. It's just, there's not time to have a full-on discussion about all your feelings and all your hopes and dreams each and every time. So there's a blend of, yeah, if you think you really got a good point, you need to be a good salesman and sell it really quick. It's an art. And again, there's no right or wrong way of doing it. At least I haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, I agree. And from the perspective of an instructor, like, you've been there too. You want those pieces of information. Like, it's not like, you know, I don't know everything. I don't know, you know, the more experience I got in F-16, like, it was very clear to me that I was missing a lot of, you know, I did not know probably as much as I should have known. You know, you start to understand all the things that you really don't understand, you know, that you don't understand, right, or remember. Anyway, so that is an important lesson. Like, it's the soft, you know, again, I hate to go back and like think that, oh, it should have been done this way. But as a soft, as an instructor, evaluator pilot, you want input, right? So I would encourage, you know, younger pilots, if you have a question and it is, like, if it's something, you have to be able to distinguish between something that is vital to the success of the mission or to safety of flight. Like, you have got to voice it up, because it's not, you know, I'm not thinking that necessarily as the instructor. The soft isn't necessarily thinking that. Again, he's got a lot of stuff going on. So I think you're exactly right. It is an art form. And then, but, you know, the experienced guys don't have all the information, or they're not necessarily processing all that information. So it's important to speak up, throw out the good ideas that you think will be, you know, important to safely completing the mission, or,
yeah,
or bringing jets home safe.
Like you said, maybe the experienced guy is not processing all of it. Definitely been on that side of, you know, the coin. Yeah, these are short radio calls back and forth, and, you know, everyone's managing a lot of different things going on. Everyone's got a lot on their mind. So I don't know. That's kind of like my biggest, you know, takeaway from the soft and like voicing your opinion. And again, it's something that is important to do, and figuring out how to do it appropriately at the right time is something to definitely, I think, take with you and, you know, try to hone and refine that. So, the worst part of this, right, obviously, is measure, you know, there's a fatal result here, but the fact that, you know, when he comes into land, the jet, the left main, is not going to support the weight of the jet. He starts rolling, he ejects. So the seat fails, the digital recovery sequencer, the DRS, I think that's there's a lot of acronyms in this AIB, doesn't work, right? So he doesn't get a shoot. Yeah, that unit was supposed to be replaced multiple times and kept getting service life extensions. I think it actually showed up to Shaw about a month before this mishap, or it showed up in the month of May before the mishap. And to consolidate maintenance efforts, the seat and the whole jet was going to be cannibalized, become a, you know, parts jet. And that's a normal cycle for maintenance. They pushed it off until July. So I think it was going to come, that jet was actually going to come off the line on July 8th. So about a week after the mishap, and everything was going to be fixed. And again, I don't know what procedures are going to change, if any are going to change with it, but it's a suit. I mean, talk about this. I absolutely, like, worst thing. I never even thought about my seat not working, right? Like, I always had that as my get out of jail free card when everything went south. So the fact that didn't work, obviously is tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the whole line. I mean, this is a tough, all AIBs are tough when there's a fatality. This one's really tough for me because again, knowing the squadron really well and the guys well that were involved, but, and then now the seat not working at the end, it's just so tragic, sad, and want to be able to, if you could pin like one thing that needed to work, you know, like to make this all, like, the thing in my mind that is not black and white is the seat needs to work. Like, it's got to work.
Yep.
because we're asking fighter pilots to, again, these planes are, I mean, they're flying around it. We do crazy stuff with these airplanes. Like refueling is something that you and I and other people who have done it a thousand times, like you don't even think about. But in reality, the precision of taking gas is like, you know, it's incredible. These airplanes are moving fast. They're in tough environments and you're touching another airplane to like get fuel from it. Like it's pretty incredible. And that's just something that we don't even think about, right? That's like, that's an admin piece of the mission that is so not simple, but it's just not even close to as complicated as the mission actually gets. So we don't even talk about it, right?
Yeah. Put your pants on, go to work.
Anyway, so that's just to say, like, it is so hard to expect, I don't know how many pages of regulations and guidance and whatever tactics manuals. I mean, there's probably 50,000 pages of instructions that an F-16 pilot is supposed to have read and digested to be able to operate his aircraft. Like, obviously you and I don't have 50,000 pages of information memorized, right? So in my mind, like those things, like the seat needs to work because I don't know it all. Like I can't react fast enough in every situation. And that's what, you know, that's why there are seats in these aircraft. Anyway, so to me again, like that's the whole thing is tragic, but this part of it is especially sad to me that, you know, that the coincidence of it should have been replaced and it was going to be replaced in a couple of days, but it wasn't at the moment that it was needed. Like that's all, you know, it's just so sad. At the same time, maintenance is, we're very familiar with what risk, you know, you can't mitigate all risk, anywhere, especially not in a fighter squadron. And so again, they're trying to get jets ready to go. So I understand that, you know, I don't think there was negligence. I don't think the AIB suggested there's any negligence either, but it shows like we are buying risk by not doing, you know, by extending service life and things like that. And we get very, if you saw open write-ups in the airplane, like these things are going to be replaced, like you wouldn't even notice it because we do it all the time. Like that stuff happens all the time.
It's not done lightly.
Bad, but you're buying risk.
I think buying risk is way is these are not done lightly. I mean, maintenance is sitting in meetings multiple times a day with leadership and they're looking at every single jet and every single write-up. They're tracking them. And again, that particular one was probably elevated to a very high level, I would imagine, to have that signed off, to buy that risk. It's like anything, you have to make sacrifices somewhere. You either don't fly or you fly and know that in the event of something happening, hopefully that's a small percentage, there's a risk that X, Y, or Z might fail. And this is, again, the Swiss cheese model, like, yeah, the stars aligned in a horrible direction and all these things where the risk was bought with a seat, like the worst fear came true with it. And it's like, yeah, it's just absolutely completely tragic. The fact that it did not work.
Yeah. That's an interesting little, I don't know. I'm trying to think what I was going to say about.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about, like the normalization of deviance. I know this is like the space, was it Columbia? Right. And it did like 120 missions and they always came back with the tiles slightly chipped. Right. And then is it Columbia that burned up? If I mess that up, I apologize. But, you know, that was the causal factor, right? All the ice on the launch that was chipping away after 100 and something missions was not an issue, but that was what ended up resulting in it burning up on reentry because we just kind of accepted the fact that this deviance is normal. So the normalization of deviance. And I don't know, this is buying risk in the situations. It's kind of apples and oranges, but it's somewhat related, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. I mean, there's a ton of stuff we can talk about. And even after you kind of identify all these issues, like it's not necessary that you can change.
Yeah.
Like if you would have seen that open write up, it would have been nice to know, you know, if you just think like, oh, this write-up was open in this aircraft, which means like there was going to be a problem with the automatic sequencer. So you might have to use the handle. Like that's great information that, you know, it would be awesome to have known that's what that meant before the sortie, right? I don't know if that's a realistic expectation for maintenance to be able to communicate all those kinds of things to the pilots. But I don't think Mesner, I would not have known looking at the write-up, like, this thing is overdue for inspection or for replacement, whatever. Yeah, yeah. Like, I wouldn't have read that and understood what the implications of that would have been. But it is interesting. Had he known what the implications of that would have been, had the SOF known what the implications of that TCTO would have been, I think certainly they would have made a different decision. I think, like, hey, if he ejects, you know, under a certain amount of thousands of feet, like, he's not, the thing's probably not going to work, or it could not work. And so he's going to have time to pull. If the SOF would have had that information and the mishap element lead and Mesner, like, the plan would have been different. So I'm not saying that he should have, like, maintenance should have made that very clear or anything. Like, right. Maybe that's not a realistic expectation, but it is important to realize that, like, there was a piece of vital information that was not understood by the people who it impacted.
Yeah, and I think you make a good point, right? I mean, there's so many, you know, on the pilot side, right? 50,000 pages, right? That's a guess, but that's probably realistic as far as information you have to know. The maintenance side of the house, like, probably magnify that, you know, by 10 when it comes to figuring out all the different parts and pieces. And there's just so many moving pieces of it. And I know, like, looking at the forms, right? Like, I would walk up the crew chief, like, good jet, right? And, like, I'm really looking at inspections, tires, like, cursory stuff, right? Because if it is typed and written in there and the forms are, that's what you go through before you accept the jet to hop in and go fly. If it is typed in there, right? Like, I know other people have looked at it, like, this thing is good. So I'm really looking at, you know, expiration dates and things like that. I know if I had seen the digital recovery sequencer, whatever, you know, push to whatever date, like, I would not have given it another thought whatsoever. But that is a good point. Like, what if you had that bit of information, it definitely would have changed my calculus stepping out the door knowing that. And, you know, in fact, you know, they had one other failure that they mentioned, AIB, the Tulsa IP, who was at altitude, super experienced guy, and it still took him like 5 seconds to do the manual override handle and get man seat separation. Mesner had no chance whatsoever. Like, there had been no chance for any pilot. I think I said it like 3.67 seconds is what he had to recognize the failure, pull the handle, and to get a shoot. There's no way. I mean, I would be able to do it, and I would argue that probably any F-16 pilot or any fighter pilot, for that matter, if they're put in that same scenario, would have thought to reach down and pull that handle at that point. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I certainly know I wouldn't have. That it reminds me of there was an F-35 mishap in Florida where he ejected on pretty much on the runway after the landing. The aircraft became uncontrollable. So he ejected from the ground, basically. And when he described his ejection, he even says, like, he doesn't remember pulling the handle. He doesn't remember anything except for he's on the ground after it's all done and his helmet's gone or something. And, you know, he's like, he thought, like, oh, like, I just, like, this is what death is, you know. But anyway, so I'm saying, like, that was probably a 7 to 8 second, or who knows, maybe it was 15 seconds from him pulling the handle to getting on the ground, and he had no, you know, recollection or he could remember ever going through any thought process. So again, like you said, like, 3 seconds, yeah, sure, it's like doable if you say it like that, but it is not executable, I should say.
Right. You got to be spring loaded and know it's going to happen. I mean, yeah, it's impossible.
Yeah, exactly. It would take me 2 seconds prior to, like, think, like, where is this handle? You know, I would start, like, I'd pull the green ring probably, I think I might merge the oxygen accidentally before I actually got to the override handle. And, but I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, crap, I need to study the F-35 seat. Like,
yeah.
Who knows what I would do in an F-35 seat? I'd probably freaking throw. I don't even know what switches are on the thing. So
it just senses what you want to do, right? Yeah. Gosh. Yeah, this is a tough one. Bender, I appreciate you kind of going through. I think a lot of the context there that is not able to be captured in the AIB is important to kind of build the picture around it. And this is one I think you and I both agree that, I mean, I can envision myself in this scenario. Like, I can, in any different plug and play, right? Making the same decisions that these guys made, because it's incredibly challenging and there's just so much data and so many things that are happening so fast that it, again, you hope that with the processes we have in place, that at some point it's going to block the error going through the Swiss cheese model. And sometimes it doesn't, right? And it just lines up. And in this case, like, and just ends in tragedy. So, you know, hearts go out to Mezzer's family. On the website, we got the Lieutenant Smith, a link to the Lieutenant Smith's foundation.org. You can go there and donate in his memory and keep his legacy going, helping young people aspire into aviation. They'll help them out. So check that out. Again, Bender, I really appreciate you taking the time today and helping out.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. I didn't know Mezzer very well, but same thing. Heart goes out to him, especially to his bros who love, you know, it's a tight community. They loved him, they cared for him, they would have done anything for him. So to see them just kind of suffer through it also, you know, it's a tragedy for everybody, you know. It's so the gamblers now are, they're downrange doing God's work. So and heart goes out to them too. Wish them all the best of luck down there.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. So, I appreciate you taking the time to do this and double down.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.